Hello, I'm Alberto Salvato. Welcome to Crime Time, a Virginia criminal law podcast. I'm here with Anna Dvorak, Anthony Norse, and Ann Thayer. Enjoy the show.
So here it is, legal disclaimer, because we are lawyers and we've got to write one. So if you are listening to this podcast, thank you. We sincerely hope you are listening to this podcast for its entertainment value and not with the intention of acquiring legal advice for any individual case or situation. I mean, come on, you wouldn't take advice from someone you have never met or spoken to directly, right? If you were bleeding profusely, you wouldn't listen to a podcast in hopes of a bandage somehow materializing over the internet and onto your 3D printer. Seeking actual legal advice can be just as important as a tourniquet. The hosts of this podcast are in no way intending to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Sorry, we are sure you all are great people, but we cannot stress enough how little we know of you and your case. And rather than risk an awkward moment, let us just remember we have never met. Nothing on this platform should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. We are just a group of friends with differing opinions and viewpoints, which we will try to explore through discussions of current events, law changes, and whatever else floats our fancy.
In today's episode, Shalossom, a public defender story. Today we have a very special guest, somebody I'm pretty sure I'm speaking for all of us. I have such high regard and respect for. He's a public defender. He has been a public defender for multiple jurisdictions, including Fairfax, Arlington County, and now with Prince William County. Prior to that, he was in private practice. I'm not sure if he remembers this, but I met him in Arlington on some random case for the first time. He probably don't remember this because he's had so many other cases, but he's someone who's handled tons of serious cases. Someone who intimidates the hell out of me, not me, but intimidates the way he handles cases, because I'm always afraid that I will disappoint him in the fact that I may not get the same outcome that he is. Shalev, you please. Oh, I actually didn't give your name. It's Shalev Ben Abraham. I probably should start with that, but listen, it's all good. How about you introduce yourself?
Well, I was going to say, you know, most judges can't say my name anyway, so they just get to, and most prosecutors, sometimes we just go to one names now. They just call me Mr. Shalev. Some call me Mr. Ben. Others call me Avrahim. So I feel like I'm just kind of like a Brazilian soccer player of public defense work. I just a one name, you know.
But anyway, I call you Kate's.
Well, now you can tell them that your name is Shalossom.
Shalossom now. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. Yeah.
That's right. I call Judge Jarvis. I called him JJ.
JJ. That's pretty good, actually. Yeah. Judge Jarvis. Yeah. Yeah. So my name is Shalev. I have known, I think, all of you guys for a fairly long time now. It's at least going on 10, 12 years for most of you, you know, in various places. As you said, I've been all over Northern Virginia. How far back do you want me to go for introductions? Like, you were way, way back, or just like
way back, like when you were like a little bit Abraham and you wanted to
whatever you want to share with the listeners.
Hockey days in Canada would be great. I know, yeah. Anne is a great hockey fan. So
okay, when Tony's one of your patriotic, stop interrupting me.
I'm sorry, I got to bring this up. He's got a great story about a certain coach in Canada that I think we'll all love to hear.
Yeah. I guess let me take it back. Way, way back. I'll brief on the family background and then kind of get more into me. So my mom's Canadian, probably fourth, fifth generation Canadian. Her family were British and a little bit of, there's a debate, Austrian or Russian. It was really during that time period where those two countries, although they weren't quite countries, but those two countries were like really fighting over certain territories. A quarter of the mom's side of the family is like, we're Austrian, because they think that's better than being the Russian side, which right now maybe. And then the other half is British. My grandmother on my mother's side, my biological grandmother on my mother's side, her father was an RAF pilot in World War II. And my grandfather, his mother, there's a book about his mother, which is, it's his stepmother, and it's called like The Queen of the Mob. And she was in Toronto, Canada, and she remarried to my grandfather's mother, passed away when he was younger. So she remarried his biological father, and she had remarried from another one where she had been married to the head of the mob in Toronto. Nice. Yeah, during the Prohibition time. So there's a book that's like kind of like kept quiet in the shelves of our homes about that. On my dad's side of the family, they go way back to, they trace it back to the Mayflower, and they're like, you know, British, and then somewhere Norwegians got involved. And so my dad, anyway, born in Nebraska, my mom in Toronto. My dad moves out to California early age. And then my dad decides, who knows why? Well, he does. He knows why. When he's like about 13, he sort of decides to not want to follow Christian faith anymore. And by the time he's 18 in Long Beach, California, he's trying to convert to Judaism. And so he converts to Judaism, not with my mom in the picture or anything. My mom's side of the family is the Jewish side of the family. So my dad goes to Berkeley for college. After Berkeley, he goes to Israel because that's what he wants to do. He just wants to live in Israel. My grandmother right now currently lives in Alabama as in a Southern Baptist on my dad's side. So this is the extent of my family. We're all over the place, right? So I got a Southern Baptist grandma who lives in Alabama. My dad converted to Judaism. My mom's side of the family is Jewish. And my long-term girlfriend right now, her family's Catholic. And so on Christmas, they're in Birmingham. We go to mass on Christmas Eve. So I've got it all. Right.
Including ties to the mafia.
Including the ties to the mafia. Well, yeah, we can come back to the ties to various things. But anyway, so he leaves, he goes to Israel. My mom grows up in Toronto and in the late 70s is kind of like not doing great in terms of going on to college and stuff like that. And so what they used to do is they would send these like sort of American Jewish kids who were kind of like messing up to be like, well, you go work on a kibbutz in Israel and send you there. And for those who don't know, kibbutz is kind of like communal living, right? It's like the small versions of Marxism in Israel. They're usually like farming, little farming community type things. So they meet over there, get married, have me. We leave when we're like 9 months old. I've never been back. I don't speak Hebrew, you know, anything like that. They get divorced when I'm about two. But because my dad was American, my mom Canadian, even though I was born in Israel, I'm an American by citizen by birth, right? Just like John McCain was and all these other people. Unfortunately, Ted Cruz, which is a great question I always have. What's the most shameful thing about Canada? Nickelback or Ted Cruz? You know, I don't know. Probably.
I didn't know Nickelback was Canadian. That's
you know, Nickelback's Canadian?
Well, I just don't listen to Nickelback, so.
Well, that's probably good. To be fair, there's a lot of Nickelback fans out there. I'm not a Nickelback fan. Yeah, the lead singer of Nickelback ended up marrying Avril Lavigne, who's also Canadian for a while.
Did not know that either.
So yeah, there was like a little royal marriage royalty thing there. So anyway, I'm way digressing already. As you can see, this happens a lot to me.
This is his opening statement on a murder trial.
No, it's more, listen, more concise than that. But yeah, sometimes I wander a bit. There's no doubt. They come back. I'm about two. They're in California. It's not really working for them. They divorce, right? They separate. My mom moves back to Toronto and I grow up, you know, 9 months out of the year in Toronto. And in the summertime, when I'm not in school, I visit my dad, who's now living in California, Southern California. He eventually moves to San Clemente, California in like 1990. That's Nixon's old hometown. For those who don't know, it's right above Camp Pendleton. It's exactly 65 miles between LA and San Diego. Beautiful place. And so I visit during the summer months and then go to school in Canada. And by the time I'm getting ready to leave high school in Canada, and we'll get back to that in a second, you know, I've decided at that point that I'm going to come down to the States. I've had a social security number my whole life because of the birth abroad. And that actually will bring me to a different story about my birth certificate. Because you know how we had that whole thing with the fake birth certificates? I'll tell you that story in a second. But so I end up coming down here and I also go to Berkeley for undergrad in California. And then after that, I took a couple years off to work. I did various things. I worked helping to build like the call box systems at apartment buildings, like doing the like programming the computer chips and stuff like that.
And then it was new. It wasn't new when you were doing it. That was just your job, kind of like installing them and putting them in.
Not in buildings. No. I mean, like I was at the warehouse, like in from like Taiwan and China, and then you would fix them up, wrap, like they would get bought by different places. We would program them, solder them if you had to, do all that, program and polish, put them in the thing, and then send them out to the different buildings and stuff like that. That's what I was doing. Yeah. For a bit. And then started, you know, studying for the LSAT, knew I was going to go to law school and took that. And then and the year after I took the LSAT, before I came to law school, I became a substitute teacher in California for about a year. I did the teaching exam and then
teaching. The kids always thought I was a student.
I didn't know you did substitute teaching, Ann. You did it too?
When I came back for breaks in college, I couldn't do the little kids. I couldn't handle, I would have such bad headaches at them. The middle school kids were okay, but I did a lot of the high school too.
Yeah, I preferred the high school, honestly. It was a lot easier to deal with than the little kids. And I think the lowest grade I ever did was like sixth grade or something like that. And that was kind of almost a disaster. So I was able to pick, like, you know, they would put up in the morning or whatever, like which schools and what it was, like subbing for like US history or whatever. And, you know, so I did that. But I also became a teaching assistant at a community college in California for the Model United Nations program they had there. And so I got paid to help people do like Model United Nations. And I got to go on some trips with that, which was kind of cool. And, you know, like Chicago for a week and DC for a time doing that while I was getting ready to go to law school. And then law school is how I ended up out here. I had gotten to the point where, and maybe this had happened to some of you, like after you come back from college, if you spend any time back at home, and this is not to insult your own family or anything like that, but like you couldn't sometimes like have a thirst for like, you want to keep learning and you kind of like in an environment before that's like more designed for that. Now you're back home and it's just like this kind of crappy 9 to 5 and you're just like, I got to get out. So I had to leave. I had to go back to school. I always wanted to be a lawyer, I think probably since I was maybe like 10, like in my growing up in my family, when we would have like family dinners, it didn't matter whether you were good at sports. It was like, can you hold your own in an argument, like around the dinner table? That's what got the kudos. And look, I don't look at now and people don't know this, but like, I was actually a pretty decent athlete. Like I was on one, you know, Little League baseball. I was on the team that finished second in the province, which means if we had won, we would have gone to the national championships to compete for like the Little League World Series. I played high school football. I played rugby. My family couldn't give a shit about that. They did not care. What they cared about was like,
who can win the argument at dinner time?
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%. Like, so it fueled my desire for it because it was almost Pavlovian, right? Like the praise you would get was like, oh, you made a really good political argument here. I'm like 13, making an argument about like why, you know, the current premier at that time was messing up something or talking about world politics and things like that. And so that's kind of like, I was kind of new, like law school would be great because like someone could pay me to make arguments. I like making arguments, get someone to pay. And we can get into the public defender side of it later because that also starts to get into that point there. So yeah, so I ended up out here for law school. I went to American Washington College of Law. I started in 2008, which, you know, that was good. It was in DC. For some reason, that was right when the big financial crisis had started, you know, that we had the housing market burst. And so I became really fascinated in part with a couple of things like securities, actually, and what was going on with that. And also, I was really fascinated by Chinese economic securities and Chinese economic law and the concepts behind that. And like this idea of like the free economic zones that they started creating in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And
yeah,
so I came to American to do
Your thirst of knowledge is way, way more than mine. I mean, I don't think I'd ever.
TikTok a lot.
That is true.
Yeah, I am not on TikTok. I was fascinated by that whole thing. And part of why I chose American was because they had a really good international law program. And they had at the time a semester abroad thing where you would go to Hong Kong and do like securities and financial stuff. And I was look, for like a brief second, even though like deep down I knew this wasn't what I was going to be, for a brief second I was like, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to do like international securities law.
And
for
it's those, okay, this isn't busting your public defender bona fide.
No, I know.
It's like, not, you might want to like do but some it was like securities law.
But it was like within like, it's funny because like after your, you know, your first what, 18 months of law school is when you get to finally start to pick classes that aren't like the core classes you take. After that point, it was all trial ad classes, like in upper level criminal law classes, and then like financial law classes. I did like mutual funds and securities and weird shit like that, that like just doesn't really sort of make a lot of sense. But I was within law school within like, you know, 2 weeks, been like, why did I come here for that? International law securities. I need to be a trial lawyer. Like I remember the time too when our, you know, our legal writing professor was like, who here wants to actually be a litigator? Who wants to be a trial lawyer? And like I was like one of only like two people who put up their hands for like, yeah, I want to be in front of a jury. The rest of them were like, no, we want to just like, you know, work on K Street or whatever and not do that.
We want to make money in civil cases.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we want to sit in an office and charge by the hour.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
No, people got to do that.
Plenty. There's, we need that all over the place. I just, you know, I like the fact that I can pick up a case and go to trial any day of the week.
Yeah. It's a, you know, that's a different world. I mean, I did. And you guys have all probably at some point in your career, I think, even though I think all of you sort of largely more focused on criminal, have touched some of the civil stuff. And my early on, I did some of that. And I did a lot of federal employment law when I first passed the bar for the local firm I was at, which was fascinating and gave me a kind of different insight into, you know, how those cases work. But I don't know, being in front of a jury and advocating for someone in a criminal context to, you know, it's really like one of the greatest things someone has an opportunity to do. And it really is, you know, I don't want to say addicting, but there's a level of addiction to like being in front of a jury and having them pay attention to you and it trying to convince them of the justice of your, that your client needs, right? And look, we don't always go to jury trials and yes, you know, sometimes you gotta, you do plea deals, but I always tried to really help the client realize what they wanted out of it. And sometimes some people just want to have a trial and it's great to be able to do that. You know, some of my clients that I've had trials for and I've lost have been the clients who like have loved me the best over some of the clients that I've won trials for, but like begrudgingly didn't really want to do it, but decided to have the trial. And, you know, it's the ones who you fight for sometimes, even if you lose, that they, you know, they see that you care about them and that's important. Yeah.
I have a, well, I'm not going to rain on your parade, but I do have a case where I undid a plea deal that a client had in general district court and he just wanted his day in court. So we appealed it, went upstairs and it was a case that had involved an amendment to a lower or lesser DWI. And I told him, look, if we appeal this, you're going to be exposed to your original charge, which is an elevated BAC within 5 years, which means 40 days.
Not 40 years.
Not 40 years. Well, the way I tried the case, he ended up with 80. But
so 40 years to try.
He had gotten, this is hilarious, he had gotten 10 days down in GDC. He was represented well. There's no question about it. But he just wanted his day in court. I show up for the appeal up in circuit court, and I draw two of the hardest, like, people to deal with. Like the prosecutor was super difficult. The judge was one, was someone who was extremely hard. We go to trial and the guy walks out with 12 months. He went from 10 days to 12 months in jail. That guy was so happy to see me every time I saw him, like afterwards. He's just like, all I wanted was my day in court. And I'm like, well, you had a lot of extra time on your hands, buddy, because should have stuck with the 10 days. But you're right. A lot of people just want to have that feeling that somebody's fighting.
That's also why you don't force your clients. Like might know that trial is the best thing for them and you have a really good shot to win, or you might know that the plea agreement's best, but like, I don't force them. Like you go over the pros, the cons, that you weigh it out for them. And ultimately it has to be their decision. And anyone that's forcing them or threatening them, or, you know, you see attorneys, they just want to leave. So they're like, take the deal, let's go. We want to get out of here, when you know, maybe you could have had a better shot at trial, or the other hand where, you know, maybe they should be taking it and you're like, okay, well, we'll go to trial. And you know, it's, but you don't maybe explain it to them. That's what it comes down to. As long as you give them all their options and it's their choice. Like at the end of the day, I tell them, you got to be happy when you leave here with whatever decision you made. And if that's, you went to trial and won, great. If it's, you went to trial and lost, but you got to have your day in court, okay. If you took the plea to avoid jail and that's what you needed the most, then that's okay too. You know, I mean, that's really, that's comes down to what part of what our job, the definition of lawyers is counseling people. And we get to go home every single time.
That's what I tell people.
Might, like, not get to.
Yeah. Like I'm walking
in. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what I think, though, that part of this is also having a bit of a PD mentality. Like for those on this podcast who have not been public defenders, but do have a PD mentality, I think all of us do, because it's sort of, there's a lot of folks. I mean, this is a tough game, the criminal defense game, and someone hires you and you get a, you know, a decent deal, right? And it's going to get done that day and you earn your fee that day. And you know that if you're going to try the case, it's going to have to get continued. You're going to have to go to another court date and you talk to the guy and you're half wanting them to just end the case so you get your fee, but they want their day in court. You know, I've definitely had a fee where I thought I would be done in one day and it's taken, you know, 4 court days because it's what my client wanted to either get the best outcome, whether it's a deal or a trial or just the experience that person wanted in their day in court. And it's hard when you have competing interests. You know, as a public defender, you get paid every 2 weeks, whether you like it or not, and you like the amount or not, it's the same amount. So it just doesn't matter how many times that person comes back to court, and you can purely practice law. But I think all of us have a duty to listen to our clients in that way. I just think that it gets more honed in either practices that focus on training their associates and that we are going to be trial lawyers. We're not just here to, you know, just end the day.
I mean, I'm sure Shalev has seen it. And we all know certain attorneys, without naming names, that, but like what Anna was saying, some just want to get in, get out, get that money out of trust. And you see it going down.
Public defender, like, Alberto, like not every office is like this, but when I was a public defender, there were attorneys that would just go in on that date and continue everything to the next date because they didn't want to try it or what, they just didn't want to deal with it. Right. And they were known for it. Like, you knew when you got like a much heavier caseload for that day, like somebody had it the last time, just moved all their cases. And that's not true in every office, but it does. No. And as a public defender, you already have a high caseload. I know I did. Right. And then once you get all the other cases that people didn't want to deal with, and then you're dealing with a client who's had like 3 or 4 different lawyers and is like, what's happening here? You know?
And I also say, like, I don't mind going in, and if I don't like the particular prosecutor that I have, you know, I'm not going to say, look, I can finish the case now. I'm going to continue the case to get more mitigation. I'm going to continue the case because I think another prosecutor would be more willing to accept the mitigation. I think whatever benefits
you're trying to get your client the best outcome that you right, can, that's exactly. part of your duty.
And if that means continuing the case, it means, you know, shoot.
Yeah, I'm not saying don't continue them. I'm saying people would continue it because it was just like difficult or they don't want to try cases.
Right. There's different reasons you don't want to try cases. There are people
want you don't want to deal with somebody getting jail, right? Like you're like, this person's going to jail. Let me just move it to somebody else's date.
And you're kind of talking about, Anna, I don't know if you guys have probably never sort of talked about this, but in some public defender's offices, there's different styles of, the offices have different styles of representation, right? There's what we call vertical representation and horizontal representation. And Anne's talking about a style that's more of the horizontal, where you're assigned, for example, like a specific day in a specific court, like the General District Court on the second Wednesday of every month. But if it gets continued from that, it may go to the next time it comes back around, it might be on a different, because the officer or the complaining witnesses, it might be the first Wednesday of the month. And so it just goes to a different attorney who is there. And that's where you get those attorneys in those sort of public defender's offices where they kind of can do that and dodge the cases. Whereas I think a lot more now, at least from my experience of all the offices I've been in, all the Northern Virginia ones I've been in, which are, you know, I was Fairfax, Arlington, and also Prince William. And before that, I was also for a time period, the cat is the cat okay there? I mean, she's
well, just... he almost knocked over the poster. Like
oh, that's funny.
Picture. It was pretty funny. He actually kind of like, he was like, whoa, wait a second.
The best part is, I was just about to say, I've only seen that cat walk by the screen in one direction. And I was like wondering how the hell it kept going around. Like, it just keeps going from left to right. It was like, what?
I don't know. She's decided to... She wants to just be a part of the show right now.
It's my smooth and soothing voice.
Tony, put your cat on. Let's see which one battles. Do they have a stare down?
Yeah, exactly. Put the cats up. And then so the northern offices, at least the ones I've been in, and I think all of the northern offices do vertical, which is you get assigned a case and you basically, as the public defender, that when you're assigned the case, you stay with it through its completion. Including, you know, general district court. And if you have to appeal it or it goes to circuit court because it's a felony through circuit court. And then if you even have to do a note and appeal to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court of Virginia, you would be the ones who write the appeal for that and stay with it. And so that then becomes less likely that you can just dump it to someone else because you basically are just continuing it yourself. But there's a whole host of reasons, that, you know, as you guys have talked about, why you would want to continue it, to gather more mitigation, or maybe they provide, which happens a lot, that, you know, discovery comes in kind of late, Brady material pops off at the last second. And so the combination also of some prosecutors who, you know, have particular things that you just know they don't do well with versus some others that do well, you know, with certain charges and things, you might want to try to hope for that. You have similar issues sometimes with the bench, quite frankly, of you may have watched. One of the things I did early on when I was a public defender was I tried to spend time watching trials, watching the people who I wanted to emulate. Some of you here, for example, I also, the ones that you sometimes would watch and you're like, oh, this isn't very good. But you learn from everyone. You learn from the ones who do it poorly, and you learn from the ones who do it decent, and you learn from the ones who do it excellent. But the big thing you also learn, you learn your opposition, you learn what prosecutors know and don't know, and you learn your judges. And you know that what judges like to do is if they is because it's what our way our legal system works, right? If facts are similar, they're going to probably rule the same way that they did previously. And so if you watch enough of that, you can have a better idea of what they're going to do in a case that presents similar. And that's the advantage, quite frankly, that I think as a public defender, I sometimes had over private defense counsel. I was just there more. I saw more a lot quicker. I didn't have to go to all the different jurisdictions. So I could sit and I could spend a whole week and say, after I did my cases, this whole week, I'm just going to spend with whatever the judge is in 2J. And I'm going to watch everything this judge does after I'm done with my cases in 2J. So that way, when I get in front of that judge again, and I'm in 2J, I have an idea what he's going to do. And that's the advantage you can get as a public defender. Now, the sacrifice.
Or is it Tony Norris? Because he still does that every single day.
Well, so listen, can I tell a quick story about Tony?
Sure.
I can tell stories about all of you, but
he's not going to tell us.
We don't normally let people talk about Tony, but we'll let it go.
I don't even know who the client was, but you know, one of the things that I know all of you have done, which I see a lot of private defense attorneys don't do, is they may have to have a sentencing. They may decide to take a plea deal, but all of you guys have written what's called mitigation sentencing memos. Okay. And I think in some respects, sometimes if you've got a real serious appointed case, you may be able to get money from the court to get yourself a special mitigation specialist. We call them, you know, the public defender has those who work for them, but for you guys to help develop like a client's story. And it's not to excuse, you know, this is what the case law says, not to excuse what they did, but to have an understanding of where they came from, why, and
what led them to where they're at now.
Yeah.
Phyllis Lawrence is someone I have used. She was excellent. I haven't seen her in years, but
who?
Phyllis Lawrence.
I don't know her. Yeah.
She was private. I used her probably a decade ago. And fact of the matter is, they're expensive. Oftentimes you're going to pay more for them than you're paying for the attorney, especially on a plea. And a lot of people just don't have that money.
No, that's true. And that's why if you're, you know, the benefit of, at least to some extent, I think the public defender's offices, we've got those people in the offices, and on those serious cases, they're a big help. And, you know, if you have those serious appointed cases and you get that, but if you don't have that, you all know and do it yourselves, which is a lot of work, right? To have to do that extra stuff after you've kind of figured out the legal aspects of it. Well, I remember watching Tony one day with a certain judge in Fairfax who can be a judge who, one, likes to treat it like an appellate bench and, you know, will really ask a lot of questions of you. And best way to put it is not always the person you want to have sentencing with, is the type of judge who, you know, may, you know, really give your clients, go above the guidelines a lot. Let's put it that way. And I was struck.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But a very, you know, very smart judge. But anyways, I'll leave it at that. And Tony wrote a mitigation memo, and it was a DUI, a felony DUI case, in which I had bad feelings that this wasn't going to go well. Wrote a mitigation memo and just did an excellent argument on mitigation and got a really incredible result. I think you got the mandatory minimum 6 months on it, which was incredible given what odds you were up against when that judge absolutely has given people 12 months on misdemeanors, let alone 6 months on a felony. And, you know, that always sort of struck me as one of the reasons why anytime someone had Tony or got, I had to get out of a case and they got Tony, I would always tell those people, you got lucky. And, you know, Tony and I have shared clients, and Tony's gone to jury trials for clients. And, you know, just, it's always sort of felt like, you know, you and you guys have all done this, taking that extra step for clients that a lot of private defense counsels don't actually do. right? They just go, oh, the guidelines say this, and they come in and they just try to argue guidelines, and it doesn't always work. So anyways, I don't know. I digress. I'm talking
about agree with you. Like, that's your chance, though, especially at a sentencing, even on some misdemeanor sentencings nowadays with the 2 o'clock dockets that they have in Fairfax or other places. That's your chance to get as much positive info before that judge as you can for your client. And ahead of, because the Commonwealth attorneys aren't writing them, you know, at least not in most of our jurisdictions. And so you got a judge that's already looking at that. And then you come in for argument. Maybe you've persuaded that judge to do something they might otherwise not have done. That doesn't, it's not a given that that's what's going to happen, but it's, why not take the opportunity to try?
And I also think now mitigation used to be primarily up in the circuit, but even now it's given much, much more weight in GDC with criminal justice reform. Frankly, I think there are more open ears. And since
with some people,
of course, I mean, you still have deaf people, of course, you know, but it's, I think with the extra funding, there's more Commonwealth attorneys. It's less of a assembly line kind of production. Not with all offices. I think in some sense it's back of a lot of attorneys aren't getting trial experience. Well, that's a different story though. But, you know, mitigation now is in all levels. You were talking about horizontal versus vertical. I mean, yeah. You have different chances now, different opportunities to present the mitigation.
You have treatment dockets now too, which we didn't have. I was on the juvenile one when I was a public defender years ago down in Fredericksburg, but they didn't have as many of them, and they do now. And I don't think all of our colleagues necessarily even know what some of the programs are or who to go to or how to get people evaluated. I'm not saying everybody, but you know, it's not as widely known as it probably should be.
But I think that's the advantage of being a public defender, because when so much of my work in the private sector, when I'm not doing court appointed cases or the type of cases I do have, where you might say this person, the people aren't bad off enough yet to do drug court or do, you know, or the mental health issue diagnosis hasn't come to the fore, or they've kept it together enough that it's their first charge, or doing a veterans treatment docket would actually be too onerous on them. And one of the nice things about being a PD or doing court appointed work is that you get to know a lot of these new programs, and then seeing how they evolve, like, and seeing how something like them or your contacts in those programs will say, you know, he's not eligible for this program, but did you know about this thing, right? Is that's how you learn. It's just starting to integrate more CSB programs, more substance use and OAR programs. And just if you do even a couple court appointed cases as a private practitioner, you start getting access to that information, so that when you have clients who aren't eligible for court appointed because of income, or they, you know, have gotten family to pay for a lawyer, that then you have resources. But I've also done things like where I think, like, a family will call me and they want me to hire me to represent their child who's in Western state because they're incompetent. So they're an adult, they're incompetent. I'm like, well, I can't be their lawyer. I can't make a contract with them. They're incapacitated. And sometimes I will represent the family instead of the child and help them, kind of guide them through what's supposed to happen, and then sort of be helpful to either the public defender or court appointed counsel that is working with them. But I think either being a public defender or knowing your local public defender is so important when you do criminal defense, when you're trying to find creative solutions to, you know, square peg kind of problems.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I've learned is with all of those programs, people don't realize how much local funding matters. So, you know, Fairfax has a really robust funding. And I'm sure the people in Fairfax say, we need more money, we need more money. That's probably true. But Fairfax has a lot of funding for a lot of those programs. They've got the Diversion First stuff. They've got the Merrifield Center. A lot of great stuff that you can point to judges when a client comes in on a possession charge of a felony drug and say, listen, you can order that person right now when he's released or she's released to go over and do an immediate intake and, you know, get involved in treatment. Arlington had a really good mental health program set up for people who came in and were held initially. They would have, you know, these mental health assessments, and they could create a treatment plan and a release plan, actually. They would have release plans where you had social workers and other workers from the local CSB there that would say, hey, we've talked to them. We know where he checks in, or, you know, these are people who might not be, not have stable housing, but we're not going to hold him in the jail, but we've got a program in place where we know where we're going to be able to meet him and make sure he gets to his court dates, or she gets to their court dates and goes to get treatment and stuff. And then I get to Prince William, and this is no knock on the people who work in the Prince William CSBs and stuff. They're fantastic. They're doing the best they can. They are woefully, woefully underfunded and understaffed. And, you know, I mean, it's shocking at how underfunded Prince William has been at that for a very long time. And it's a huge problem. It's one of the biggest challenges we as a PD's office. So we opened up not more than two and a half years, you know, August 2020, something around there. So maybe a little over half years, right? And it was the first thing that I came to realize. I said, wait a second, this is crazy. So, I mean, just give you an example on timelines, right? In Fairfax, if you meet with a client who you think is incompetent to stand trial, so this is not whether they're not guilty by reason of insanity, but just they come in and they're in either some kind of state where they don't understand what's going on. And that could be because of mental health or other things like that. You know, the turnaround time when you've done a competency to stand trial evaluation is what? Less than a week? About a week you can get it back in front of the court. Usually, I haven't been there in a while. What is that? Someone tell me.
It's pretty quick. And GC, I think if you think there's competency, as soon as you get that file, you can file for the next day for motion.
Right. But I'm just saying, how long does it take for them to go and see the person and bring it back?
That's taking longer. I would say the evals are coming back. I think, Tony, I mean, I think we're running into staffing issues as well. And the people who do the evaluations because of COVID, I think things did. Are we talking about 30 days to get the eval back?
I was going
to
say, I thought it was like a month or two.
It's
okay. It used to be a lot quicker. It used to be like 7 days.
Yeah. No,
probably pre-COVID.
No. Yeah. We don't have. Yeah.
Okay.
So and the number of, I will say the number of evaluators, there was not that many for a while. I don't know if that's changed, but we lost a lot of people who are doing evaluations.
And that might be.
Well, I think it's pre-COVID. But there's also a bigger number of evaluations too, I think, on top of like losing the amount of people doing the eval.
So, yes. I mean, but the pre-COVID was like about a week, right? Give or take. Something
like pre-COVID. I still think that's kind of on the short end, but it might've been, I don't know.
Well, Arlington was like 72 hours.
Wow. Right?
Yeah, like Arlington was like 72 hours.
Yeah, but Arlington is small.
Agreed. I get it. Yeah. But also funded, right? Versus like the length of time it takes in Prince William. And there's just not, there's, let's talk about other, here's another issue. So right now, and I don't know, again, this is pre-COVID. I don't know what it's, I haven't been in Fairfax since then. But it used to be that in the morning at the jail, there would be always a Spanish interpreter on call at the jail, a certified Spanish interpreter. I see Tony making faces, so that might have changed recently.
Yeah, but there was always one. Yes.
And there was one or two usually in the afternoon. And so if you had clients who spoke Spanish, you could just show up. You didn't have to book, and you would show up and they'd be there. And sometimes you'd wait your turn for someone else to talk to someone, but then you would have your opportunity to do that. You have to schedule. We don't have that in Prince William. In order to get Spanish interpreters to come to the jail, you have to schedule them out. And the hours, they're only like rarely, there's like one that's available on any regular basis between 1 and 3. You can't get anyone to go in the morning. Forget going between the hours of 8 and 11, which is when the professional visiting in the morning is. The one person will do 1 to 3, and someone used to do like from 5 to 6. That is not enough time with the numbers to go see these people. Now, also add this, and next time you have Judge Jarvis on, you can ask him about this. They have a problem with just having staffing for interpreters for the courthouse. And part of the problem you ran, again, talking about sort of the funding that people don't realize, Prince William is situated in such a way that if you are an interpreter and you live in Arlington, you will not get paid your per diem for travel, you know, wear and tear on your car to come to Prince William as an interpreter. It's not far enough. So if you live in Arlington, it takes an hour. You know, with traffic, it could take an hour and a half to get from Arlington to Prince William, and, you know, one way, depending on traffic. And they won't pay them to make it there. So if I'm an interpreter, why do I want to go to Prince William if I can go to Arlington, I can go to Fairfax, I can go into Maryland.
DC and Maryland pay better, I think.
Pay better. So, and I'll say this, plug this,
Metro accessible.
I don't know exactly what happened legislatively, but I know that there was a bill to double the fees for court-appointed attorneys in Virginia, and it died in the legislature this last session with much of everything that probably died. But like, court-appointeds need to be able to get paid more. You know, $120 for a misdemeanor case that could honestly take, if you have a blood DUI, you know, that's a point, let's say above a 0.15 accident case, you're talking about at minimum two court dates, right? Maybe three. And if you have to have a trial on that, and you have to prepare, and this is just general
district. 4 hours.
Yeah. I mean, 4 hours. What?
In Fairfax, you're not going to get more than 4 hours for a trial.
Well, what I'm saying though is you working
it's 3 hours.
talking about just a trial is 4 hours.
Yeah, but you don't.
Right.
Yeah, but
that
you
doesn't get, include like, everything else.
Yeah, but you don't get paid for like you have.
You don't get paid that.
You get paid $120.
You get paid $120, and then, you might put 10 or 15 hours into that case before you even have to appeal it. What are you? You're making $10 an hour?
Shalev, I just got appointed to. I've never done appointed work, but I got appointed to an appeal.
$400.
I have gone to jail 32 times confirmed and had a minimum of 2 hours each time, over 65 hours in just jail visits without even typing a word outside of jail. I am going to come out making probably $3.50 an hour.
Yeah. Or -$3.50.
You're
going to
make less. I mean, I don't even know. Are they
going to give? I don't even think it's going to be $3.50.
Matter of fact, I've decided to make a donation so I could. I'm going to donate $6,000 because I get a better tax write off.
I mean, no, but like.
But I've done the same thing. I've been helping out Fairfax JDR with court appointed stuff, and I told Tony I haven't even signed up to get the payments because I'm like the amount of time it would probably take me to figure all that out and do forms and deal with getting paid. Like, I'm just helping out. Well, I only take cases when I'm already there that day anyway. So I'm like,
And to add insult to injury is that we have to ask for a waiver, which is a discretionary to the court. Yeah. So, and there's other states where they actually have a cap. You build up to this cap. It's
a federal system. Waiver.
In the federal system, or like New York does that, they had a lawsuit against their public defense system, which we should have too. So that system is much better paid. We have the waiver system, and the waiver system, you know, we have judges that people will say, I worked up to a jury trial. I put in this many hours. It pled at the last second to something my client could not refuse, right? So you don't do a jury, and they put in for their time, which is totally legit, and they get a cut. And they're like, thank you for your service. And it's like, why should we sign up for this? I know lawyers that have gone off the list because of that.
Let me say this. I have two things about that. Three, because we can like start to talk about the money stuff. So first, public defenders are woefully paid. But why I think this is important for two reasons about court appointed. I think court appointed are also woefully paid. And it's a problem. Virginia probably is now.
We're below Mississippi.
We're below. Yeah, we could be like 49th or to 50th. In the country, in what we pay our court appointed, it's like the worst. It's right there with the worst. And what that does is it incentivizes bad lawyering for people. And that's where I'm upset about. Let me tell you a story. I won't name who this person is, but I was a public defender in Fairfax, and I was in the JDR. I was in JDR, and I was representing one of four kids who had been charged with, like, they went into someone's house, okay? And, you know, the person was gone on vacation and they ran amok, as kids might do. That person said the damage was like $50,000, which, you know, no 12 and 13-year-old kids are ever going to pay off restitution of $50,000, right? But I'm sitting around a table with, and none of you guys here, obviously, sitting around a table with the lawyers who are representing each of the individual kids. So I'm the public defender, and three other stalwart is the best way to put it. JDR, Fairfax, old school JDR appointed attorneys. I think probably all of them are either retired or moved on, but aren't actually taking cases anymore. We're sitting around, and it's like, I want to say it's like May and near Memorial Day. Okay. And one of them says, you know, there's a lot of money on this restitution. You know, I don't know that these kids can pay that off. That's certainly what my thing was. I was like, yeah, I've got case law that says like this is unconscionable, right? Like, you guys had Brian Kennedy on once. He, you know, came up with this whole argument about, like, you can't put $10,000 of restitution on a 13-year-old kid. They're never going to pay it off. It's, you know, so I'm ready to argue this whole thing out, right? And we're talking about it. So one of them says, and I'm kid you not, says, you know what we need to do? We need to continue this. So we can have this argument, but we need to continue it to July 1 or after. So that way we can put in waivers because there'll be money for us to get paid. Now, what that means is that the money for the extra fees for the waivers, that eventually runs out, right? Like the Supreme Court of Virginia says at some point there's no money. And so if you're, and the budget starts July 1, if you get a murder trial that you work through and you do the murder trial and it's a week long and you've put in 100 hours of prep and you have your almost 40 hours of court time and you do that murder trial in June, and or let's say you do it in May and you have to submit your bill and it goes in June, the Supreme Court may just not pay you the waiver that you're entitled to, even if the judge approves it, because the money's not there. And so we now have lawyers discussing openly in this scenario where I'm back, going back now 7 years or so, discussing openly that they need to just continue the case into the new fiscal cycle so they can bill more and get paid on it. In that scenario, you know, the continuance, my case, I ended up managing to put it on a different date and do my own thing. I don't really know what happened with co-defendants, but that's a big move. I try to get away from other people, but
especially in a circumstance like that,
you can understand that that can have serious ramifications for a client's case if the lawyer has to think through the logistics of, well, what I really need to do is just continue this out a little bit more so I can make sure I get my waiver fees. Now, they're not supposed to think like that, right? You're not supposed to, but how do you criticize? I mean, you can criticize it, but like,
it's, you know, it's not unethical. I mean, the judges know too. They're like, look, your client's out. Do you want to set this in July for the sentencing, like right? For a court case? Because the money's gone. Everybody knows the money's gone. And so you're like, well, we could set it in July. And you're just like, you know, it can't be the only consideration, but if it doesn't harm your client and you actually get paid, like it helps your client to know, like, you could actually
right. pay. But part of it, I agree with you on that. But the part is, we all know that it's happening in ways that it is harming clients.
And no, so we do.
Right. And so I think this is why, one of the reasons why I think they need to raise the amounts of money. And you're still going to have them, but they raise amounts of money because we need to have better quality representation across the board. And we need to have court appointeds who can do the job as court appointeds and get paid more on it. So it incentivizes those amongst you who are good at this and actually care about those clients to continue to do the work. Because if you guys who are on those lists doing the court appointed are forcing the Commonwealth to work harder and forcing to do the trials, right? That helps us all, right? It helps us all if the Commonwealth has to work harder to prove their cases because you guys can afford to work harder as well on those court appointed cases. Ultimately, whether you come to do these things for whatever reason that drives you, what drives me to be a public defender can sometimes change on any given day. But ultimately, all of us as defense attorneys, right, I think, believe in the concept that the government needs to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, right? The Constitution requires that. And that is what we are here to do. We are the true protectors of the Constitution, right? I know that the PD's office in Fairfax, I think, used to have that shirt that said, if you like your constitutional rights, you know, thank three groups of people. It was like the founding fathers, veterans, and your local public defender's office, right? Because it's certainly not the government that's trying to protect your constitutional rights when you're in a court system. Heck no. Without getting too critical, judges have eviscerated the Fourth Amendment. Forget having the right to, you know, not be searched and seized and all of that. I like when the bar that I'm practicing in is a bar that takes things to trial, litigates, and pushes back because it helps us all out. It makes us all better. And
I can, I'll give you an example of that. You gave me some issues with it. You guys in Prince William did this great movement at, you know, with discovery and filing these great, you know, very detailed discovery motions in general district court. And I remember it caused quite a bit of a, you know, ruckus there because it was something new. We all benefited from it because, you know, you did that. You guys are there every day. You have an army of PDs who are able to go in front, and whatever, you know, benefit, whatever advances happen in the court, we all benefit from it. And I remember you gave me a hard time because I was like, yeah, why do I have to put the motion on? You guys are doing it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you have to listen. The tough thing always, right? The thing we can't do in a PD's office, but God, I wish we could, is collective defense, right? Like I've thought about how great it would be to walk in one day and have 10 cases and just say everything's for trial, right? You guys know this, like people don't, at least in the bench trials.
You could.
You have to have 10 clients.
Yeah, and you have 10 clients that agree.
In the second or third trial, people are going to start casing.
Yep. So listen, there was a day back in when I was in general district court in Fairfax, and there was a young prosecutor who you guys may remember who ended up going on to, I think, Kentucky, who notoriously lost some DUI trials because she kept forgetting to ask where the venue and jurisdiction was. But in any event, there was a day where a particular judge was on the bench at that time. And that particular judge, I knew you could make an argument about calibrations, speeding calibrations. And it's sort
of on St. Patty's Day.
Right. Yeah.
I think exactly. We're talking about the same.
Oh, yes. We're talking about the same judge. And, you know, I'll tell you that the first time it happened that I was able to come to that argument is funny because they say, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So I'd been thinking about this for a while. And there was another former public defender who's in private practice that you guys know by the name of Patrick Blanche. And he's got one of the cases that Patrick Blanche has is Grant versus Commonwealth. And in that case, it's about certificates of analysis for breath machines and DUIs. And it was right after all the confrontation stuff came out. Mm-hmm. And our court said, listen, the testimonial thing on the bottom of that certificate where the police officer says, you know, I testify, you know, that this has happened.
I follow the methods, the specifications, all that crap.
It's testimony. And if the officer who signed it doesn't show up, the Supreme Court has said you can't bring that in. It's testimonial. So I was thinking about that and talking amongst other PDs about it, some other ones, and we back and forth. And I was like, you know, why doesn't that apply to the calibrations for speed, right? Same thing. It says we testify that on this date I did X, Y, and Y. Why not? Well, it's never been done before. That's the one I love the best. It's never been done before. That's my favorite thing to hear, right? Because I'm like, all right, well, let's give this a shot. So I have a really nice, great guy prosecutor who's now since moved on and love him dearly. Always had a smile on his face. He's now moved on to another government agency. I think you know who he is. And he was like, look, your guy was, they got him clocked at like 95 and I don't want jail. Right. This is back when they used to do jail for that speed. I don't want jail, but like I got to take the reckless driving conviction. My guy happens to be in the military. And for whatever reason, look, I'll be honest. People, I've had clients who are in the military. They tell me things all the time. Like if I get a conviction, I'm going to get kicked out of the military. I don't know. Sure. Maybe not. Who knows what happens with a misdemeanor or not. But his
Mark
like
Zaid does. Or what,
huh?
All right. One of our guests, Mark Zaid.
You know, it depends on how many other problems they've had.
And right? Joe Yoon too. He deals with that.
Right. So I got the this guy's sergeant's there and he's telling me, yeah, look, listen, this particular guy, if he gets a conviction, they're going to, what do they call separate you or separate to start the separation process to boot you out and, you know, whatever. So I go to this prosecutor and it's not his fault. You know, this is his marching orders. And I'm like, I can't take it. We're in front of this judge. This particular judge, this one you said, like if it was St. Patrick's Day, had previously may have made comments such as, it's malpractice for anyone to try a high-speed reckless in front of me. So even if the file was marked no more continuances, he would let you continue it. because
not true. He didn't. I asked for a continuance once after he gave me that speech, and he said, denied. You have to try the case.
Well, maybe that was just with you. But in any event, so, you know.
He literally told me that the day before at lunch.
Yeah, so that's probably why he did it then, because he told you at lunch. It was like, oh, you're coming in here to do that. So anyways, I have no choice. I got to try this. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to give this a shot. So they go to move the calibrations in. I'm like, objection, confrontation. And, you know, the prosecutor's like, well, wait a second. No, but this is, we've been doing this for years and years now, and it's past cover, whatever. And so the judge sustains it, right? And he says, yeah, the code of, he points to the code of Virginia, says this comes in. And his famous line to that was, the code of Virginia doesn't trump the Constitution of the United States, which is true. And two things, I'll get back to that in a second. So I win this. So fast forward, there's a day that a current full sitting judge, I believe, is the one who nicknamed this day. He called it the Red Wedding Day in GDC, where I had a bunch of cases, a bunch of lawyers had cases, and this prosecutor who was just not making any deals. And so I was forced to have to try like four cases in a row. For whatever reason, she didn't get the message that this is what was going to happen. And so I went up and it was like one after the other, like, and it was with this airport police officer who had just been like the worst. She was real mean in the vestibule. Your clients need to go to jail, blah, 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 whatever. Right. And it was like one after the other. And after about the third one in a row, which only took like 30 minutes. So I had like 10 minutes of time to get, because she couldn't figure out what was happening. She like took a break. And I just remember other attorneys coming up, and then it was just like candy. It was like, hey, I'll take an improper. And she was like, fine. Like things that they, you know, she was not offering before. And so, you know, back to where this all started. Yeah. I mean, you can try to do that and you can try to go to trial on a bunch of stuff, but eventually what ends up happening, this is why it's great when you can do it, the system breaks down and they have to give you either really good things or they're going to have to drop stuff because it's impossible for them to try, you know, everything. But as lawyers, our ethics say that we have to treat, you know, every client individually when they give us an offer and what's in the best interest, and it's the client's choice. And so you can't really come in and say, I'm not taking any plea offers. You have an ethical duty to provide the plea offer to the client. If the client wants to take it, it's your job to have them take it. You know, you can talk to clients about whether the plea offer is good or not, but it would be great if I could one day, if we could all just come in one day and just everyone just say, everything's for jury trial, everything's for trial, the entire system would break down.
Like, you know, what that's called is the mock trial class. Like, there's no other world where we can do a trial with no consequences. I mean, that's the end of the day. It's like, we don't.
There are just so many of our clients will take certainty over doubt. I mean, and I don't blame them in a lot of cases, but it's funny. I had with another judge who celebrates what I would expect celebrate St. Patrick's Day a lot.
You guys are cracking me up. Alberto normally rhymes names. I like the like describing like.
I can't. Clue. There's two.
This particular one who likes the St. Patrick's Day, does he tend to bike a lot?
No. Different one. The other day I was getting, I think they serve them now, McDonald's in McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
So it was.
Does he celebrate St. Patrick's Day or is that Scottish?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm pretty sure Scottish, right?
And that means you celebrate every day. And
there we go. There we go. So this, you're right. I never even thought about
having a Scottish maiden name of Livingston,
which I want to come back to him in a second too, because I've got a great story.
He's awesome. He's awesome. But I happened to go first in a DWI trial, and it was one of those days where the officer had like this particular officer had five or six DWIs, and they were all going to go to trial, or at least some were going to plead. But I happened to go to trial first because my particular judge was pretty quick, and. So I tried the first case, and I threw out this argument about, I asked the officer, what's the difference between the methods and the specifications? Because in the attestation clause on the certificate of analysis, it says there's two. I have yet to meet any police officer who's able to describe the two. Now, it's only worked, I think, twice in my life. I lost it 2 days ago, but still, they cannot do this. Well, when I won this, everybody else afterwards was like, well, we got this trial going on. The poor officer was actually really candid. He ran outside. He's on the phone asking his superiors what the answer is. And like, of course, the judge is like, hey, time to go. He runs back inside. And I like to say I was responsible for winning four cases that day.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was a bad happy hour rhymes with that, who managed to lose his case. But anyhow, it was a great day. I love
it. About that particular judge, I saw him. He was sub-judging a few months ago, and I walked in because anytime I see some of these old judges that I did a lot of stuff with before, you know, you come and you say hi. And he was like, oh, so you're out here at the PD's office out here. And I was like, yeah, you know, and we're building this office up and trying to teach him to do it right. And you know what he said to me? He said, just remember, you know, two things. I was like, what's that? He said, write bench memos in GDC. I'm bored. I hear the same stuff over and over again. If you hand me a piece of paper with stuff on it, I'm going to read it and it's going to swing the day probably. And two, always do an opening argument. And he said that, always do an opening argument. You know, and he goes, and you know why? And he's like, tell your people to always do an opening argument because it's your first and really only time to testify. And you need to do that. And it's like, he's not wrong about like either of those things. And
your first judge said the same thing. The first person we're talking about said the exact same thing.
Yeah, but there's other judges that don't. They're like, come on, let's go. Let's call your first
witness. Well, I will say that there are times when I have a case, let's say it's going to start a trial at noon. And I know that I have four or five issues and I will announce, Your Honor, there's a bunch of things and I have four or five issues. So let's start with number one. I have three suppression issues and two major evidentiary issues. It's amazing how sometimes making those announcements. Well,
that's the benefit of knowing who your judges are and being in court all the time. And Tony, I think, was there for this one. I had one particular judge who would get red in the face when he was there longer than he should have been. And I had this one case, was a Friday and it was getting close to noon. Everyone's getting hungry. And this particular prosecutor was not known for breaking anything down ever and just going to trial on every case. Well, it was a 0.16 DWI. I stood up in front of this judge and I said, Judge, I have an opening statement. He goes, what is it? I'm like, I'm just trying to get this down to a 0.14. He blew a 0.14 on the PBT and it's 0.16 on the BAC. This judge looks at the prosecutor and says, are you going to make me sit through an hour and a half trial for me to find him guilty of a 0.14? And he's saying this as he's writing the disposition on the back of it was the fastest case I've ever had where I got, he's like, I'm going to find you guilty of a 0.14. And just no evidence, nothing, just an opening statement. You never know,
like,
man.
Agreed.
And I'm not saying that happened in Fairfax or Arlington, Prince William, or even in Virginia, but it happened.
Well, I can tell you the only time I've really had a group collective one was one time there was a particular prosecutor that was not known to making any offers, but also known to being very good at that person's job. So you weren't getting offers and you're like, crap, I'm going to have to go to trial with this person and it's not going to be fun. But there were six of us, more than six of us at prelims. And one of the other lawyers has said, are you getting an offer? I'm like, no. And everybody else like, no. And I'm like, all right, everything's for prelim. Because everyone's like, it was like wave and plead on all the felonies. And we're like, well, what do we got to lose? Yeah. And all of a sudden that person was like, oh, offer. This isn't going to work. And it was just offer, offer, offer. I mean, my guy got 12 months straight up on a misdemeanor, but considering he had 14 prior felonies, I was like, okay, that will take 12 months.
It works, right? Like if you can do it, it works. It definitely puts pressure on them.
But it's very impromptu. You can't like go in there plan, but you got to sit there and basically know. Well, you've got to know your case and you've got to know your judge and you know your prosecutor. I think the hardest thing I have found as a private practitioner, I go to your jurisdiction tomorrow for a bond motion, is to learn all the different ins and outs. Like, can you argue bond at arraignment? Can you do different, like, what can you do? Or do you get a blue sheet or do you get someone's record? Can I call a witness? And I feel like it is very nerve-wracking as a private practitioner to like, you know, I mean, I call in favors all the time. So I'm like, what happens here? Because I'm not seeing it every day. And even now in Fairfax, I go to court. I do go to court, but I'm not in court every day like the public defender is. And so I've got to be, you know, calling everyone and saying, hey, have you seen what this person's doing recently on recklesses or how are they taking the calibration argument? Because it's just, you know, it takes a lot of work to maintain that. And, you know, if you're in court every day, unless you're doing, I don't do a volume practice, like a traffic practice, which you're doing, like if you're doing 5 to 10 traffic cases a day, which is a good practice, you're doing a bunch of infractions and recklesses, you're going to see a lot more of what's going on. There's a lot of really good attorneys, like people here, but like Andrew Kersey is a really good attorney in traffic court and in general, but he will, you know, he's there. He knows the pulse of different jurisdictions. I would say he's mostly in Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William.
You know, you bring up an interesting thing because there are, depending on cases, they really, and depending on jurisdiction, there are different attorneys that are better for different cases than others. And when people ask me, you know, because I can only do cases in Prince William, right? And so if someone asked me, for example, like, you know, who, you know, I need someone in Arlington, right? You know, some of you guys go to Arlington, right? But there's some people that don't go to Arlington. And there's some, though, like you said, that like are really good at like Luke Nichols, who basically doesn't practice because he makes so much more money doing his YouTube stuff, yep. Right? High Speed Reckless, that man knows more about High Speed Recklesses than I think any of us all combined together. So you would say, Luke Nichols, Luke Nichols, go do a High Speed Reckless, right? You're in good hands with that. Could he do, if he was hired to do a murder? Sure. Would he take it? Probably not, because that's not his area, right? And so you have lawyers who do everything, and you have lawyers who are more specialized, and you know, in the various things. And it's the only way to kind of know that is to keep your ear to the ground. And I appreciate that Anna didn't call me out, because she texted me earlier this week, hey, what goes on in your jurisdiction about, can I argue arraignment at bond? And then she shows up in my jurisdiction on Tuesday, looking at me in JDR. And I was like, oh, you wanted me to, I forgot to answer that question. She's like, it's already done. I did it. You didn't answer the question. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about that. Or happened is I ended up going to the Springsteen concert and I just didn't answer.
Anna, did you just give our guests a hard time? Passively aggressively?
What's funny, he said the same thing to me.
Aggressively. I was extremely aggressive on Tuesday.
He said the same thing to me when I was asking to schedule this podcast episode. He's like, oh, I forgot to get back to you. I was like, yeah, that was 2 months ago, Shalev.
So listen, honestly, like, we all are super busy. I see the text messages come in, and what I want to do is not just like, I want to go look at my calendar and see what works. And then like legitimately things are popping off. Like one of the things, it happens to all of us, but it definitely, I know, I feel like it happens just because of the volume more for us, is the constant fires you have to put out. Right? Jesus. You guys have constant fires. People calling you all the time. I do too. I mean, look, I'll give you an example. Monday, I left a little early, took half the day off because I was going to go to the concert, get back home. And, you know, it's 1:30 and a client of mine's calling, right? And he's telling me about how there's new warrants out for him. So I got to spend the next 2.5 hours talking through with him, talking to the complaining witness in this case, who agreed to talk to me, getting my investigator to talk to the complaining witness, telling him, turn yourself in, I'll show up at arraignment. Now I've got a statement, like all of this, you know, out of the blue, right? And so you get a text message from Anna at the same time asking me how these things go. And I'm doing so many things that I forget to respond to her because, you know, my focus is now shifted to that. And I know that I got to be better about it, but that's kind of like how these go. There's just so much. And then the big problem is, it's not a problem. I have the work I got to do, but I am, when you move up, and in our office in particular, we started with so many brand new attorneys who are still, you know, learning how to be attorneys, let alone public defenders. You know, the supervision is vastly different than anything I've had to do before. And I'm talking about simplest things like, you know, where I'm not putting out emails to the whole office every time someone's asking me, like, how do I appeal bench trial? You know, we lost the bench trial. How do I make sure we appeal and have an appeal bond? Well, you're not sending out emails to someone. So every time it happens, a new person, you got to explain the process to them. That's like 30, 40 minutes every single time. And if that happens to you 3-4 times a week, that takes up a lot of time. And okay, it's good because now they learn it. You teach them the right way. They're good to go. But yeah.
You need to make some YouTube videos and have a thing that when, for all the different frequently asked question things like that, that come up so that you can have them sit and watch it as things come up. That's what they teach.
Or, you know, we can do new topics on the podcast that are like training videos, you know, like our jury one that we did with Ann's sister, Jeff over in Arlington said that he's been using that to talk to people about how juries.
Like, he was a juror on a case, so we got to get the like ins and outs.
Who was a juror on the case? Your sister? That's awesome.
With a former police detective as a father and a sister as a defense attorney. I don't know how the hell she made it. She said when people kept getting excused, she kept trying to inch her way up because she's wanted on like so bad.
Yeah.
And they all knew, like, Catcher, Overhand, and who was the other one on there? Heywood. They all knew that
Heywood was on it.
That's
Heywood had great hair.
That's great. What's funny about Jeff, and he won't mind me insulting him, I'll tell this story real quick. This is back when the Casey Anthony trial was going on. I don't know if maybe might have been. Were you around for this one when this happened? One of you, maybe you guys were around. So at some point, the group of lawyers are kind of like watching it on TV. They're trying to decide where they're going for lunch, because that's also a big deal when you're in private practice. Where, you know, for them, where are we going for lunch? Especially that firm in particular. They spent hours trying to figure that out.
I know. It was like the second job.
I'm going to lunch every day.
And so at one point, all of a sudden, Jeff pipes up and he's like, hey, did you see that? That guy's interrupting that other guy in court. And one of the other, I think it was Karen Kasaya, just turned and said, yeah, Jeff, that's called an objection. You would know that if you did a jury trial. It was pretty funny.
I miss Karen Kasaya. She was badass, man. I'm sure she still is, but that's a long time.
You want to talk to someone, if you guys, you should get her on the podcast. You know, she went down to Georgia and did capital defense, and now she's up doing Gitmo cases. She's back in the area and she's doing
work.
So, oh, wow, that would be awesome, Tommy.
Yeah, you guys could have I don't know how much she's allowed to talk to you about that. Who knows? She had to do like a security clearance.
We'll probably have to have the silent podcast where we basically think it right out loud.
But no, yeah.
But speaking of silent podcasts,
it is great on that podcast, by the way, the silent one.
Tony, you're here.
The host of your silent podcast is here, Anthony Norris. Yeah. Now be 10 minutes.
Hey, he comes in with zingers or like nuggets of gold, like often. But
he came in with this great title, Shalawesome.
Yeah,
but speaking of, we really loved having you on.
And there's one thing I have to hold on. I know we have to go, but we have to touch on the hockey. I think it was the football coach that you had. For everyone to know, you guys will be amazed.
So I went to high school in Canada, and I went to a high school called Newton Brook Secondary School. Go Northmen. I played football at Newton Brook. My high school football coach at Newton Brook was a man by the name of Rob Ford. So Rob Ford, this is back in 2000, 2001 timeframe, right? Rob Ford was a councilman on Toronto City Council at the time, and great high school football coach. In fact, in my last year of playing high school football, we actually were like ranked as like one of the top 10 in the province, which Canada, you know, Ontario is the biggest province population wise. It's, you know, 10, 11 million people. And anyways, Rob Ford was my coach. He later goes on to become the mayor of Toronto. In fact, he's the mayor of Toronto that you may know, who was caught doing crack and is on video. He was my high school football coach. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of opinions about him. I firmly will say this, take this all the way. He really cared about the kids and what he was trying to do. Anyways, so he got caught doing the crack, but I remember... Do you ever remember the SNL skit where Chris Farley plays the man down by, like, the motivational speaker, and he comes in and he's like, you're going to live in a van down by the river. So Rob Ford would get real low when he would yell at us about stuff. And I swear to God, it was, he'd have a suit on because he'd come from like the city council, and he would look like Chris Farley, just, you know, doing the whole thing. And it was really funny. Anyways, I remember we were undefeated. We were supposed to have like a bye before the playoffs started. And the backup quarterback, he started lecturing us. He'd heard that there was going to be a football party, right? And he lectured us for like 10 minutes about, y'all, you don't, you know, he didn't say y'all because he's Canadian. I all of a sudden picked up this y'all stuff somehow, living down here in the South-ish. I call it South-ish because it is the South, but you know what I mean. He's yelling at us about like, don't mess up your opportunity. You have a chance to like win the championship. Don't do stupid stuff. Don't get drunk and get in trouble, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the backup quarterback goes, Coach, I got a question. He's like, yeah, what is it? He's like, well, Coach, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? This is legitimate, right? And he says, well, son, you know you're an alcoholic if you drink alone. And without missing a beat, he says, but you know, you can always drink with me, yourself, and I. And I was like,
oh my God.
Yeah. So you talk about, this is the high schoolers. Now, to be fair, at the time, some of us were legally able to drink because in Toronto, Ontario, like you just had to be like 19 to drink. And you also had 5 years of high school back then. So you actually were like a senior and you could be 19 and in high school and not like back grade. But looking back on it years later, I was like, oh, there might've been some telltale signs here of like
substance abuse
that I hadn't really seen. I'll just say this quickly. He was great to us as a team. He put his own money in to restart the football program in my high school. When I started my high school, we didn't have a football team. We didn't have football. He paid for all of the equipment to create the team and to train it and brought in coaches to do it. And he really was committed to that. Even when he was mayor of Toronto, he still, after he left us, he ended up coaching other high school teams. And he was a good coach. He played college football in Canada, which is not that big a deal. He was actually a big Washington football fan. He said, he told us he came down and did like a camp when he was a young kid down here at the time. So that was his favorite NFL team. You know, he cared about the kids and he thought that it would help them people to get off and play football and get off the streets and stuff. So I always was endeared to him for that, besides all the other crap. You know what I mean? Which is probably why I like the concept of public defense to me is like, you know, everyone's got mitigation. Even the mayor of Toronto, who, you know, was caught smoking crack. Everyone is not the sum, you know, you're not the sum of the worst thing you did on any single day. Right. Yeah.
That's an awesome way to end. I was just going to ask if you had any final thoughts, and I feel like that's
you nailed it.
Yeah. Did I? I mean, I don't even know. Here's a question. I mean, at some point too, and I'm not trying to just invite myself back, but you know, I would love
Blake
to
does talk it all the time. So don't worry.
Who about does?
Blake invites himself back.
Blake Wallace and his brother Wallace.
Didn't he co-host
Wallace
for a bit?
He's trying to hijack the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was out, he tried to keep me out.
Yeah. I would love to come back and talk to you guys about some like discreet things, even like talk about how I approach Brady, for example, or things like that. Or, you know, even individual cases that, you know, without naming them, like case story concepts of like how these sort of played out in some of the, you know, the big thing I always think about with this is like, you know, a chessboard and a checkers board are the same board. And the Commonwealths are playing checkers with me and I'm playing chess. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what you got to kind of like do with some of these things. And they don't realize it until it's too late. You know, and that's the.
No, we'd love to have you back.
Here's some like fun stories. I mean,
just make sure everything is you're isolated from any problems when you come up. Cause I don't put yourself out too much. But
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, listen. I mean, I could talk about stuff that's like from other jurisdictions, not even stuff that's happened in this one, right?
We use the word hypothetical.
Yeah, hypotheticals. Yeah. Wasn't something on the listserv recently? Someone was like, "Who was?" One of the Loudoun attorneys was like, what does this HC stand for or something? And someone responded, hypothetical client. Did you guys catch that? You saw that, right? I'm not losing my mind. Did you see that? You guys are laughing. I know you saw it.
We see a lot of things kindly not commenting, Loudoun lawyers.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Shalawesome, for joining us. It really was a great episode. I enjoy these attorney spotlights because we get to know our fellow colleagues and even those especially those I admire. After episodes like this, I respect them even much more.
All right. Yeah, this is an awesome episode. Thanks for coming on and we hope to have you next.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me, guys.
And Shalev, just so you know, this is when I stop talking.
Say goodnight to Anthony.
Thanks for joining us on Crime Time. Please join us again for our next episode.
If you enjoy our podcast, Crime Time, with Virginia defense attorneys, be sure to share our podcast with someone that you know. You can find our podcast on most of the major platforms like Spotify, Google, and Apple, as well as some of the smaller podcast platforms. We also post on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, so you can find our episodes there every week on Tuesday at 9 a.m. If you want to leave us a review or a comment and tell us what topics you'd like to hear about, we always welcome feedback, and we're always looking for new ideas and guests to bring onto our show. We hope you keep listening, and thanks for being a supporter of our podcast.